and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis. I wanted to start this podcast because it felt like there were lots of roles, be it in distribution, marketing, programming, post-production, or even on a film set, that don't get the attention they deserve. Likewise to the women doing those jobs. I'll be interviewing guests on how they got their start in the film industry, what it is they actually do, what keeps them motivated, and what their ambitions are. Hello, pod pals. How are you doing? Has everyone remembered that it's Mother's Day on Sunday? And also, what films are you watching and would you recommend? I saw Us on Friday night, which was ambitious and menacing and a bit mental and a bit brilliant, and also features one of the best uses of good vibrations in a film I might have ever seen. In terms of female directed stuff, I was also lucky enough to catch a preview of The Souvenir recently, Joanna Hogg's latest film. And let me tell you, I have so many thoughts and I'm still thinking about it, and I might need to write something down to properly digest it. It's a proper grown-up film, I think, from a filmmaker who's really honed her style and voice. I think it's coming out in August, courtesy of Curzon Artificial Eye. I doubt you'll miss the posters and trailers and the hype, but yeah, definitely go out and see that in cinemas when it's out. So anyway, my guest this week is Jo Duncombe, whose CV, as you will shortly find out, is a bit ridiculous. She is currently Shorts Programme Manager at the British Film Council and continues to curate and consult at Bird's Eye View, championing new cinema created by women with nationwide touring programmes. Previous roles include being a film programmer at the Independent Cinema Office as well as programme director at the London Short Film Festival. In 2015, Jo co-founded The Quarter Club, a network for women working in the creative industries, where she curates quarterly salons with her best mate Saskia. Jo has also worked as an impact release strategist and fundraiser on documentaries including A Syrian Love Story and Even When I Fall. Jo and I chat about her various roles across these organisations, as well as what living on a boat is like, and her very cool side hustle. I'm a bit in awe of Jo and how much she does, and I've known about her work, at least on a surface level, for a good few years, so it was a real pleasure to dig deeper and hear about how she got into programming. Jo is completely lovely, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Before we crack on though, I have a couple of points of admin. The first is that I'm currently in Copenhagen for CPH Docs, and due to watching lots of documentaries and trying not to eat too many pastries, the pod will most likely be on hiatus next week whilst I find time to edit the next episode. The wait shouldn't be too long though. The second is that, as you can probably tell by the somewhat amateur production, this is a one-woman show, and I really appreciate everyone who's listening as the podcast goes through its troublesome toddler phase. With that in mind, if anyone can recommend any good recording studio spaces in London that might be able to offer their facilities for pennies, I would love, love, love to hear from you. My email is on my website bestgirlgrip.com, or you can hit me up on Twitter at stonecoldfox. Without further ado, this is episode 12 of Best Girl Grip. A good place to sort of just jump straight in terms of talking about what you do at the British Council and what even are the British Council.
It's a really good question. The British Council are basically a government body, a cultural body, who half their work, or the majority of their work, really is about teaching English as a foreign language around the world. But the other side of it is about working with artists to facilitate cultural exchange. And our job in the film team is about promoting British artists and building opportunities for them internationally so that they can showcase their work internationally at festivals, but also engage in cultural activities outside of the UK and develop their skills outside of the UK. So it's all about kind of international relations, but through the lens of film, which is a really interesting space to be in.
Absolutely. And what's your role there?
So my job at the British Council is a part-time role. There's a team, a film team there, and there are lots of other arts teams. But the film team has a set of programme managers, so I'm a programme manager. And my specialism is short film and new talent. And then, as I was saying, I look after a region as well. So I look after film activity from the UK in Europe.
And why short film is your specialism? Can you talk about kind of how you came into that?
How I came into that. So I think my interest in short film really started, well, I mean, this will become a bit of a career biography, I suppose, because my first ever job in film was at Bird's Eye View when it was a film festival, back in 2013. And we were doing a season on women filmmakers from the MENA region, so Arab women filmmakers, and we had a programme of short films. And I hadn't really explored short film before. It was kind of before the time that the internet made short film so readily available. And so as a form, I hadn't really ever explored it, and I was just fascinated by how well-crafted these films were and how much they were doing within the space of 5 to 10 minutes. I'd studied literature at university originally and loved short stories, and again was always fascinated by the craft that has to go into really honing and getting all the beats right in such a short amount of space on the page. And this then opened my eyes to how that could also translate onto screen in a really amazing way. And then from that, I moved into working at London Short Film Festival, which is where I kind of really cut my teeth, I think, and understanding the importance of short film in the industry and how incredible it can be for a space, as a space for artists to try things out and experiment and find their voice and take risks. And I am very much in awe of filmmakers who can really nail a short film.
What were you doing at LSF, running it?
So I started as a producer. So I worked with Philip Wilson, who's the artistic director there, yeah. In the first year as a producer. But Phil is someone who is really amazing at encouraging people to think about the things that they're passionate about and work out ways to build programmes around them. So he kind of taught me how to do that. And then while I was there, we'd never really done anything with the Arts Council for funding. I think one of the things about working on a film festival is you realise how much things are run on a shoestring. Mm-hmm. And we were always desperately looking for innovative ways to make money through sponsorship, through funding, through all kinds of different ways. And as a producer, I was really involved in that. And I realised that we'd never done anything with the Arts Council. We'd done, obviously, stuff with the BFI for funding. But the Arts Council was different because they don't generally fund things that are film in a way that you might imagine. They're not interested in narrative films that, you know, that will be funded elsewhere by bodies like the BFI. Mm-hmm. They're interested in artists moving image. They're interested in work that collaborates across different mediums. And so I sort of started becoming interested in an artist animator and the musician Gazelle Twin, who's just released a new album. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of started building this idea for a project where Gazelle Twin would make some music and live performance to some animated videos. Through that, the project, funded by the Arts Council, and it was the first time I'd ever been involved in any commissioning of anything, and also by being part of building a programme around something. And it worked really well, and we got really good audiences for it, and it was really a nice thing to do in terms of also giving two artists an opportunity to do something they hadn't done before and to develop skills as well. And it was just really exciting, and I hadn't ever done anything like that before. And there was the space at LSFF London Short Film Festival to do that, because they're just, you know, when there's so little money and so everyone's having to get stuck in all over the place, mm-hmm. there is actually some liberty to kind of just get stuck into things yeah. you haven't done before. And so the following year on the festival, I went back to the Arts Council, and we did a screening called Cats and Cats and Cats, and it was all about cat videos. So we did a short programme of cat videos about cats that were on the internet. But then we also commissioned various artists, including one of my faves, Jennifer Reeder, who's made some incredible short films and has just done her first feature film that she's written and directed. And yeah, we kind of commissioned them to make films about cats, and it was amazing. And we had also some archive films, like Maya Deren's made an amazing film about cats, a really beautiful film. So we showed these all in this huge, it's in Clapton, the kind of big dome-shaped church building. But it was amazing. It was sold out. We had loads of people there dressed up in cats costumes, and it was just this incredible thing of like building a programme around a kind of a cultural zeitgeist thing, but also realising that you could embed some really interesting artistic ideas and build spaces for artists to kind of explore new things. So after that, I spoke to Phil and I was like, I think I'm as interested in programming as I am in producing. Mm. And we kind of worked out that I would be the program director and he would be the artistic director. And then we had the festival director, who's now the head of the festival, Sarah Chorley. And we worked as a kind of collaborative trio. Mm. And I was still doing loads of producing and I was still producing. But yeah, I was also, then that was my kind of doors opening into programming and putting ideas together.
I mean, so many questions, but the first is sort of what, obviously the raising of the money and thinking about the programme and getting it on its feet, basically, but what else is entailed in producing a festival? And then I guess the second part of that is why was programming, what really spoke to you about that?
So, I mean, producing a film festival, I mean, London Short Film Festival is quite an interesting example because of the nature of short film and the number of programmes there are, you're dealing with a traffic of, like, I think we had, like, thousands of submissions, and we would have, I think when I was there, and Phil will probably correct me, but I think when I was there it was around 400 films in the programme. Mm-hmm. And the first year I produced the programme was the first year the festival decided to deliver the films entirely on DCP, digital cinema print. Previously, you know, there were all sorts of different formats that you could deliver on, and it was quite sort of the print transport, as you call it, was quite cumbersome, but it was a system that had been in place for many years and was working. And then that year that I came on, it was like, we're doing everything digitally, DCP, and it was so stressful. I mean, it was one of those things where the night before I had a call from one of the technical guys who said to me that they didn't have any of the films for the opening night film ready for the programme. Oh, and I thought I was gonna, it was horrible, so horrible. I was so frightened because it was the first like gig I'd ever had that where I had a kind of producer credit, and I was terrified of just destroying my career. But we managed to put it round and it was amazing. But so it's like managing all of that, managing all the films coming in and out of the festival, managing the submissions process, managing the way that filmmakers and corresponded with, dealing with the venues and the technical demands of the venues, and making sure that the venues have got the right stuff and you've got the right stuff to give them from the filmmakers. And then it's all about funding and making sure that you've got your applications into the BFI at the right time. Arts Council, looking at sponsorship decks and building opportunities where you can work with brands that seem to fit closely enough with the festival's ethos, so as they don't undersell or sort of start to unravel that ethos. So it's about making quite careful judgments about, you know, what seems to work and what doesn't. And then why did I move in? Why was it programming? Yeah. I think because I came from a creative background. I studied theatre, actually, theatre and English literature. And then I'd done a master's degree after that whilst I was working in London, working in a PR company, I think, doing event production. So I was doing part-time master's, part-time work. So coming from that world, the master's was in cultural contemporary culture at Birkbeck, which is just around the corner. It was amazing and I had the best time doing it. But I was always really interested in storytelling and ways to weave storytelling into cultural experiences and communal experiences. And I think theatre really, the work that I did in theatre really kind of opened my eyes to that, and how moving and important and profound that can be on small scales, big scales, whatever. And so I kind of found when I was producing that I was doing a lot of the like work that distracted me from the stories that you can weave through building programmes. And I was watching the programmers doing that and I was like, that's what I want to do. That really interests me. Yeah. I'm really interested in how you can build stories around stories, and you can build stories around the way people come to discover stories.
Can you give me an example of sort of something that you've thought that would be a really interesting theme or strand to program, and how that idea comes to you, and then how you form the films around it?
Okay, that's quite a big question. So, for example, last year at London Short Film Festival, I put on a screening of a film called The House is Black by the Iranian poet Farooq Farrokhzad. And she was an incredibly renowned poet who died very young in quite tragic circumstances. And this was the only film she made about, and it's a documentary film that's narrated by her and has a poem that overlies it. And it's the story of a leper colony in northwest Iran in a place called Tabriz. I think. And I watched the film because a friend of mine showed it to me. She was doing a course at SOAS around the corner, and she had seen this film. And she said, "Joe, have you ever seen this film? It's incredible, The House is Black." And I said, "No, I've never seen it." And she sent me the link to it, and I sat down in my bedroom, watched it, and I cried and I cried, and I could not believe the humanity of this film, how beautiful it was, how moving it was, and I wanted to find a way to show the film, but I knew that, you know, with a cursory search, that nobody had shown it in a long time, and it's very hard to get the rights to the film. But I also wanted to think about, you know, getting over that challenge of making the film available, but also finding a way to frame that discussion and invite interesting people who could provide the right context for that film, knowing that I'm not an expert about Iranian culture, but wanting to be able to share and talk about and learn more. And I think that's a really interesting thing that programmers have to do, particularly in kind of curated programs of archive or archive film or thematic programs, is the programmer has to really have an appetite to know more too, and that helps to frame the conversation that you have afterwards and guide who you invite to speak. And so after what felt like an almost impossible task, finding the rights owner to the film and getting permission, which was a no, then a yes, then a maybe, then a no, and then eventually a yes.
Because of money, legal, like...
No, it's actually quite a personal story about the person who had the rights to the film also was quite selective about who he would allow to screen the film.
Right.
And being someone, a total randomer, who he didn't know or have any contact with previously, I had to rely quite heavily on people recommending and suggesting that, you know, it would be a good programme. And then the other problem was that the only existing DCP print of the film was in Iranian, Farsi, and subtitled in French, burnt French subtitles. So there's no space on the screen to have English subtitles.
Okay.
And the whole film is a kind of, is basically beautiful and powerful footage of the filmmaker in the colony, leper colony, and also it's just poetry. It's poetry that matches with the rhythm of the film. And so the language is really important, and being able to communicate the language is really important. So then it was this like really complicated way of trying to find a technician, who I did eventually find, who could help me find a way to build the English subtitles onto the screen, but not on the print of the film.
Okay.
Anyway, those are all technical things that were almost impossible, but in the end, I invited Elham Shakarafar, who's an amazing film producer and who I also worked with at Bird's Eye View originally.
Yeah, she's got a lot of Love and Lore out at the
moment. Yeah, she has. Yeah. And she's amazing, and she'd spoken to me so much. She's Iranian, and Iranian, French, Irish, but her Iranian culture is she's just very generous in sharing the poetry of the country, and I'd been to dinner at her house a few times and she'd shared some poetry with me, and so I knew that she was really invested in, had been really enriched in her life by the poetry of Farooq Farrokhzad, so she came to speak and also read some poetry. And I think that was something that was really important to me for that programme, was to be able to wrap the story of the film and how it came into being around also the experience of hearing poetry read, and not just the poetry in the film, but other poems of hers. And I've kind of always been interested in that. I've been interested in how film intersects with other art forms.
Yeah.
And this film really spoke to the way that poetry can be experienced visually but also orally.
And how important is context in programming? That seems to be like placing it in a kind of, especially in maybe contentious or, you know, where people might have issues with the film being shown.
Like. Or with you as somebody presenting it. Yeah, I think it's really, really important. And I think that's something that the people that I admire most in the industry are the people that think deeply and carefully about how they put work out without ever claiming ownership, and also trying wherever possible to work with collaborators to expand the story beyond one viewpoint. And I think that's incredibly important. And as I say, there's so many things that I'm not an expert on anything actually at all. and so I'm always like, whenever I'm thinking about putting a program together, it's about inviting other people who can make you feel like you've come away having learnt something, something's been illuminated for you that might then pique other interests. So it's about the programmer thinking about how the audience are feeling and what they would want the audience to come away with, and that is context, but also other people's narratives that can shine a light on the thing you've just seen.
Mm. Is that what motivates you in situations where obviously a film is hard to get hold of and there are, you know, technical nightmares left, right and centre? Is the idea of showing something that has never been seen before or would maybe go unseen, is that sort of what you're...
Yeah, I think so. I think there's also a kind of a risk of being like... There's a risk of being in that thought of wanting to be some kind of like... saviour or pioneer, and it's not that, it's just
arbiter.
It's not that, it's just like, hang on, I've seen this thing that piques my interest, and I don't know if it would pique anyone else's interest, but let's explore that, let's see who else I can find that's also interested in that, and then let's try and, you know, collectively have a really interesting deep conversation about that after a screening. And you know, so many times I've come away from screenings where there's been really great conversations after a film and I've been moved to tears, or I've met someone in the audience who's also talked to me about their story. And I think there's a lot of like beef that people have around the Q&A is this kind of like format that, you know, isn't interesting, and actually we should just sit and watch the film that we've just that's been programmed and then go away and take from it what we take from it. But you know, particularly in the work that I've done with Bird's Eye View, the Reclaim the Frame program, which is all about building audiences and communities around films all across the country. What we always do there, and what Mia Bays, who's amazing, runs Bird's Eye View, what we did together was build this idea of the film screening being a space where we could invite a range of people from across a range of different disciplines doing different things very much outside of the film world to come and discuss what's in the film and kickstart a dialogue with the audience, not a kind of here's us talking about what we know as experts. It's like, these are some of my reactions to this based on my world experience as a psychologist, or my world experience as a film critic, or as an actor, or you know, so many different things that people that you can invite to come and talk about a film, and it doesn't have to be people from the film industry. And some of those conversations, I mean, all of those conversations, enriched me and illuminated things for me, and made me more curious about the film and enhance the film. So I think it's really important to make space for that in the cinema, and to make cinemas community spaces where more stories can be told and shared, not just on screen.
Completely. I'd love to talk about Bird's Eye View, because I came across Mia and your name back when it was a festival.
Yeah.
And so you obviously have been with it through the last few years, and it's undergone quite a big period of change and pivoted to become something quite different. So can you just talk about kind of how that change was incurred, and what you're doing now, what else Reclaim the Fame is kind of doing.
So it's when I start, and Bird's Eye View's been running, I think, since for a long time, like 2003,
Well over a decade.
Yeah, a long time. It started out, it was run by a woman called Rachel Millwood, and it was a film festival, and it happened every year at the BFI, and it was all about celebrating women filmmakers from around the world. And then I came on in 2014 when Kate Gariver came on board as the festival director, and she was brilliant, and she kind of really revamped the festival, and Elham Shakarafar was programming it. She was amazing. It was just this really like amazing team, and I got chucked in as a kind of like an intern, and I was doing like 2 days a week and then working I can't remember what I was doing, but I was definitely doing something to make pay the bills.
Okay. And how did you hear about that intern role?
It was on a website. Yeah. It came up on a website, and it was like, you know, expenses paid, and I was like, okay. I knew someone who was doing, who'd worked at Bird's Eye View before, and I was like, she's doing something that I'd really like to do. She'd moved on to LFF, mm-hmm. London Film Festival, and I was like, that sounds really cool. I'll just give it a go. But obviously, I didn't have any experience in film at all. But amazingly, I got that gig, and then it just, yeah, it was amazing. I loved it. I loved being able to watch all the films. I loved, you know, recruiting the volunteers and working with the volunteers, and I just found it so exciting that all of these stories from all around the world could come into one building over a weekend, and it was just brilliant. And then it ran for another year after that, but funding was dwindling. And
who was funding it initially?
Sorry. It was a BFI.
Okay.
And I think there was some private funding for it as well, which I don't know the ins and outs of, but I think that had started to run out as well, so the festival just had to stop, and it kind of went on this hiatus. And Mia Bays, who's an amazing producer and just a powerhouse, had been sort of on the board, I think, for Bird's Eye View, and she'd been involved and kind of started to think about how it might need to be, to change its remit a bit. Mm-hmm. This word celebrating women filmmakers kept coming up, and the idea of celebrating, we talked about it a lot as being quite kind of problematic, this idea that women filmmakers could be celebrated and then it goes, and we wanted to think about how actually there needed to be something more sustained and regular. Yeah, so Mia started, Kate Gariver set up Filmonomics, which was a training program for filmmakers through Bird's Eye View, and that started running before Kate left, and then Mia kind of kept that going. And so the training was kind of keeping the organisation ticking over. Right. And then eventually Mia was like, okay, I want to do like a national project that is not just this one-off festival, but this kind of regular programming that also builds audiences and communities as a movement that keeps growing. Mm. And that's when she contacted me. At the time, I was working at the Independent Cinema Office as a programmer, and it was a lovely job, and I really enjoyed it. But I was kind of starting to get itchy feet and interested in taking on something new. And Mia approached me and said, do you want to get involved? I think we're going to get this funding. She did get the funding, and then I was like, yes, I've always wanted to work with Mia. And we did this, we sort of spent the next few months in a room at Mia's amazing studio in Vauxhall, and we were just like batting our brains together, coming up with the idea of Reclaim the Frame, which would become this touring programme of films directed by women, written or directed by women from anywhere in the world, that we thought would have a big enough distribution campaign behind them to help us, you know, to give us a big enough platform to, you know, start connecting with audiences in quite a big way. And from there, it just kind of, it worked. We picked the cinemas around the country that we wanted to work with. We set up these town hall style meetings where we worked with local influencers on the ground who knew the cultural scene in each city, so that Mia and I weren't these two kind of London birds flying in.
Here's how you do it.
And so we worked with people on the ground, and we set up these town hall events where we sort of explained the idea, which was that you could, as a member of Reclaim the Frame, you would get a free ticket to the cinema, but it could only be activated by bringing someone new who hadn't been before, and they would pay for a ticket. So the idea was that you
you can make big audiences for films in that way, and it's about word of mouth and also building communities. So that was the one side of it, and then the other side of it was how we presented and framed the films, which is, as I was talking about earlier, all about bringing in local experts from a range of different disciplines and interests to come and contextualise, talk and think about the film and have a conversation with the people in the room. You know, that formula has worked really, really well. It's been really interesting to see how people come back week on week, month on month rather. And the other thing we do is often have a kind of communal element or activity afterwards. So when we showed Chloe Zhao's The Rider, we had workshops making bandanas. After Deborah Haywood's Pincushion, we had craft workshops making pincushions.
Yeah.
After Anya Zvada and JR's Faces Places, we had photography workshops. And so in each place that meant working with local experts who aren't from the film world, who come with their own community and their own network of followers, and bringing them into the cinema space. And it's just been so incredibly rewarding, and it's been refunded by the BFI, it's expanding, and it's just really exciting. But it's also one of those jobs that is incredibly exhausting, and Mio is one of those amazing people who you come across every now and again, who just seems to be able to work with so much energy and enthusiasm all the time. She's tireless. And I, at that time, I also got the job at British Council, and I eventually was starting to burn out a bit, so I couldn't keep both up at the same time. Yeah. So I don't work on a regular basis with Bird's Eye View anymore, but Mia's an amazing friend, and we stay in touch, and when she needs help, I'm there.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It reminds me, I just read Gloria Steinem's memoir about her life on the road and how she sort of did a lot of the grassroots campaigning and town hall meetings and restoring power to kind of local communities, and it actually feels a lot like that, sort of this like roadshow of taking films but almost like giving them ownership over the screenings of it.
It's all about partnership and collaboration and community, and that means we were so worried about when we were first conceptualising it, coming in as I say, like these two Londoners with big ideas about how things should work or shouldn't work. And the truth is, we don't know. We never knew what the audiences in Plymouth were going to be like, or in Birmingham. And every place is so different, and every place has so many amazing people working on the ground who know the audience and know the culture so much better. So it's just about a kind of a model that works, and saying, you know, who are the people who want to kind of explore how it might work here.
You just mentioned burnout, and like obviously preventing that, I feel like is a big thing at the moment, because especially in our generation, it's very easy to sort of bite off more than you can chew, or feel like you're not necessarily doing enough.
Yeah.
How do you manage your time, and how do you stop yourself from burning out?
Well, I think one of the things I did was make this big decision to stop doing Bird's Eye View regularly, because with British Council that meant being... they're both bigger jobs than the amount of days that they are on paper. So I think sometimes making decisions like that, but that comes with being able to make those decisions, is also a privilege, because, you know, for me, I'm lucky. I live on a boat and I don't pay huge amounts of rent, and so I can afford to take the risk of saying, I'll pick up on the other 2 days a week, I'll pick up gigs as and when they come in. And I think that's the big fear for every person who freelances, is you need to like hustle as much as you can, because you don't know when any of those gigs might stop. You can't rely on them as a kind of year-round thing all the time. So yeah, it is frightening. But I think also for me, like, I'm someone who loves nature and I love being outside, and living on a boat has been something that's really given me space to switch off and to just be calm.
When did you decide to do that? Because it's quite, I don't know, it was quite a big move.
It happened because So my partner had just moved from Bristol to live with me in London, and that felt like a really big move. And he moved into this flat share that we were in Hackney. And it was like this kind of decaying old house, and it was sort of owned by these two sisters who'd not lived in the house since like 1960, but also not done anything to the house since 1960. So it was an amazing house, but it was like falling apart at the seams. And for that reason, it was like manageably cheap. But because of, I don't know, I guess they were like, oh, actually, we could probably make quite a hefty amount of money on the house. One day we came home, about a month after my partner had moved in, and we just saw a for sale sign up, and we were like, oh god.
Oh, no.
And it was kind of shocking,
yeah.
But I was also like, this is London, this is how the city works. We sent an email around to some friends and we were like, does anyone know where we can live? And a friend of ours had a boat and she was like, oh, I'm not in it over the winter.
Mm.
And so we were like, okay, we'll give it a go. And it was over the winter, and it was last winter when the Beast from the East was here, which feels like very strange, but I'm thinking now about how unseasonably hot it is in February, March. Yeah. And it was the cruelest winter, it was really cold, but we still had a really good time and we really liked it, so we decided to stay. So that's what we're doing. And it's kind of crazy because we don't have electricity in the same way. We've got a fire and it's really calm. Like, I come home from work and I'll read and cook and talk. Obviously I'm a film programmer, so one of the things I had to do was make sure that I could use my computer, and so that was one of my big like tasks at the beginning, was working out how to make sure I could watch films on the boat. I've learned lots about weird tech. But yeah, it's been really good, and I find that having that headspace and the peace of like being on the water, and the like hard work of it, like, you know, having to like lift wood, carry logs around, coal around. It's quite Victorian, but it's really, I really like it. It really works with that. I feel like if I don't get out in nature and walk and, you know, look at things, I get frustrated. And I think I was getting frustrated, and this has really opened up that space for me.
Amazing. It's not the answer I was expecting, but it's so interesting. You also run the Quarter Club, and I went to one of your events, I think it was last year, at the Vault.
Oh, cool.
So can you talk a little bit about how that idea came about and what you do with them?
Yeah. So the Quarter Club I run with my best mate, Saskia Roddick. We set it up in 2015, I think. We were both freelancing. So this is when I was freelancing on London Short Film Festival, Bird's Eye View Festival, doing lots of different short-term gigs. And Saskia had just finished training to be an actress and was also freelancing, doing lots of other jobs to support the odd acting gig that had come up. And we were both like, this is really like stressful, and there's no one really to turn to. There's no one to talk to about how hard it is to navigate your way through that freelance world. There's no, like, we always joke, we say this all the time, but there's no HR person when you're freelancing. You're kind of on your own. And then we realised that how comforting it was to talk to each other about that, even though we were working in very different fields. And we realised, we started running these little like supper clubs in this tiny flat we had in Crystal Palace, right on the edge of Crystal Palace, and it was so small. And we'd invite a group of different women from friends from different worlds who didn't know each other to come together and have dinner and talk about their experiences freelancing or working in the creative industries. And again, we found, oh god, this is really enriching, and it's really exciting, and it's really comforting to know that, you know, people, that we can talk about this, and that, you know, it makes you feel a bit more powerful when you're aware that there are other people going through similar things. And then so we decided to heck with it, we'll do a big salon. So we just booked a big space, and we were like invited, we wrote on Twitter to women who we thought were doing really cool things, asked them to talk for 5 minutes on a theme, and I think our first theme was courage. And they, like, we were amazed that people actually said yes, because, you know, who were we? We had like 30 followers on Twitter or something. And then from there it just grew. So now, I mean, it's
something that we do on the side of our other work. Mm. We've never paid ourselves, it's just about building a community, making conversation like that accessible by trying to keep ticket prices super, super low. Mm. You know, we one of the things we were thinking about when we set it up was how, you know, it would be great, wouldn't it, if you could go and go to a talk about courage or go to a talk about balance. But, you know, these tickets, you know, School of Life tickets are like £30 or whatever, it's really expensive. So we were like, okay, we'll try and keep tickets at £10 so that, and with that, you would always get a glass of wine and some food. Because we think that those are like eating and drinking is a really nice way to connect with people, it's a really good leveller. And so we just sort of did it and it worked and it grew. And each time we had the speakers, we'd ask them for the next time for recommendations for other speakers, and it grew and grew. And now we're at this point where we're kind of like, we can't do it as regularly. It was supposed to be every quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do it because it's a lot of work, event, basically managing an event and finding the speakers and selling the tickets. Both of us are pretty shit at social media. I don't like. I really struggle with it, and I wish I was better, but I'm terrified of it. And Sass is kind of the same. So we're not very good. We're not natural marketeers, I suppose. And so it's just quite. But luckily, I think word of mouth around it has always been really good, and so we've always managed to sell out. Mm. But I think we're at a point now where we're trying to think about where to take it and how to keep it going, because it's we haven't done anything for a while.
But then I've always quite admired those kind of events or those projects that you don't feel the need to kind of do it month on month, or it can be as and when it suits you. That's
what I wanted to hear.
I'm also quite interested by your career, like from what you said about sort of you wanted to work with Mia, and something that's been popping up in this podcast quite a lot is that people get jobs through contacts or through cultivating contacts or going where they know someone.
Yeah.
Is that something you've noticed in your sort of career?
Yeah, I mean, I think I came into the industry without any contacts. I didn't know anyone. I hadn't studied film. I'd always loved film, but I hadn't studied film. And so it was, like, really scary. And I think falling into Bird's Eye View, as I did, in this, like, really lucky way, and it was luck, I met Elham, and she's been a real inspiration. She's really taught me a lot about hard graft, about being meaningful with the work that you do and thinking carefully about how you do it. She taught me a lot, and she also gave me one of the best pieces of advice about freelancing, which was that you just have to trust. You have to trust that you're good and that you care and that people will respond to that. And I've always kind of kept that thought with me when I'm like my heart's beating and I'm frightened about not getting another gig. And so when Elham moved on from Bird's Eye View, she's producing films, and she's always been a producer. And so through that, I kind of, the things I'd learnt at Bird's Eye View, she thought that I could also make useful with her on releasing some of the films that she's put out into the world. So I had the privilege of working with her on the release of her film A Syrian Love Story by Sean McAllister, and also the fundraising campaign for Even When I Fall.
Yeah, that's a beautiful film.
It's a really beautiful film. Mm. So yeah, certainly, like, I did get gigs through that, but also Bird's Eye View, also there's an amazing network of women in the industry who've worked at that organisation.
Yeah.
And it's like this kind of, it's lovely that you know, I've stayed with the organisation on and off throughout my career, and I've been able to dip in and dip out and stay part of that story in some way, and the people who are also connected to that story. But there were also just, I think everywhere I've worked, I've met women who have reassured me or inspired me in different ways. And I think, you know, whenever you go to work somewhere or you want to work somewhere, it's about, you know, the nature of the film industry is about people's stories. And I think that's not just for the filmmakers, it's for the people who are supporting the filmmakers and helping to provide platforms for filmmakers. Everyone's got a story, and I think anyone who works in the film industry, I think, is interested in stories and the people behind them. So I think, it is about making good connections and caring about people's stories. And hoping that people care about yours and help me to develop it. I've got nothing, you know, I don't have any horror stories. I think it's, I've always been supported emotionally, which is really important. Mm.
Coming back to what you do at British Council and where they run lots of schemes that support filmmakers in kind of perhaps different ways, you know, not just funding sort of projects, sort of helping them go out to film festivals. Can you talk a bit about those various schemes?
Yeah, that's quite a big part of my job, actually, is the short support scheme. And that centres around a kind of building opportunities for short filmmakers to attend international festivals with their work. Mm. It's quite often that short filmmakers, when they get into a festival, don't get any support at all from the festival or from a sales agent, because there aren't many sales agents for short film. Yeah. And that's kind of infuriating, because often short filmmakers are at the start of their career, they're emerging, and they don't have, you know, funds behind them to get them out to to festivals, but the festivals when they get there are really useful and really great for making contacts and exposure. So the travel grants that we offer for short filmmakers exist to help people get to festivals, and we've got a kind of list of key festivals that we work with, tier A and tier B, and they run all the way through the year. And if you get into any of those festivals, you can write to us and say, I've gotten into this festival, can you help me go? And more or less the answer is yes if the festival's on the list. So that, and I think that's an amazing scheme, and, you know, I can't claim any credit for it at all. I just, like, picked it up, and it's like, a really lovely thing to read through filmmakers' feedback about what the experience was for them attending different festivals. And I'm, you know, hoping that there are ways that we can, the British Council can also help provide similar grants and funding opportunities for development programmes and training, which is something that's kind of hopefully in the footing for this coming year.
What's the value in that? What do you see the value in that being?
In training, obviously. Yeah. Well, I think it comes back to this idea of international exchange and being able to, you know, we're in a global community, and obviously the internet has helped so much in terms of being enabling people to exchange ideas with other people all over the world, but there's nothing like, you know, being in a room with people and having these great interpersonal connections and learning interpersonally about new ideas. And I think, you know, that's internationalism at its best, and that's kind of what I think, you know, we can't just live in a bubble. It's all about, you know, being able to learn from people all over the world and share. And that's hopefully what a programme like that will encourage and facilitate.
What's the most rewarding part of that job?
It's definitely meeting the filmmakers and watching their work. Like, every film that applies for a travel grant I watch, so that's seeing all of the latest work from talented filmmakers in the UK and getting a kind of grip on what is fascinating people at the moment, what the trends are, but also just you know, discovering some amazing voices in cinema, and, you know, seeing all that, they, you know, particularly because they're short films, like imagining like the trajectory of the people who made the films, and it's just really, it's just so exciting.
Is this the direction you thought your career would go in? Do you have any sense of?
I have no idea. I'm not someone who ever grew up with like one idea of what I wanted to be. I knew that I wanted to work around stories in some way. But beyond that, no, I didn't. And I've kind of always followed my nose. I've followed the things that interest me, and I've not always done the things that I love. You know, I didn't love producing particularly. And I've had to stop doing things where actually life balance falls out of kilter and you can't cope. So yeah, it's not what I thought I'd be doing, but it's not, I don't think I ever knew what I wanted to be doing. I'm not one of those people that had a kind of set goal. I read through one of my old, like a little biography, a biography that I'd written when I was 7 years old for a school project, and in it I'd written that I wanted to be a vet or in EastEnders.
Keeping your options open.
Yeah,
I really wanted to be a vet actually for a really long time as a kid, and then I learned that it actually required
sticking along the house bum.
That's the thing.
Was it Trudy? Do you remember Trudy?
Yes. Yeah, I used to watch her at the hospital.
Yeah.
And
I was a bit in love with Trudy.
Yeah, me too. She was my idol.
And then I saw her put her hand up a girl's bum, and I was like, and that's it. Like,
start. Not considering my career options.
EastEnders it is.
So the way I've sort of been wrapping these up is asking, what is a film that you think is undervalued by a woman director that more people should be seeing? And I feel like with your incredible programming knowledge, you'll have lots.
Well, yeah, I was thinking about, I think the film that I would encourage everyone to go and see in the next few weeks is one of Elham's films, Of Love and Law, directed by Hikaru Toda. It's a really beautiful film about a couple, two men living in Osaka in Japan, and they're both lawyers, and they're the first like openly gay law firm in Japan, and the film follows as they kind of take on the cases of various clients in the country who are kind of doing things and behaving in ways that are against the kind of conformity of Japanese culture. And some of the characters you meet on the journey in the film are so, so brave and funny and playful.
This is a giant artist.
Yeah,
her vagina is particularly brilliant. I think, yeah.
Rapa Dinashko, who's like, she makes vaginas, and she made vagina art, and she gets into trouble with the law because her art is perceived as being obscene, and the lawyers Fumi and Kazu take on her case to suggest that it's obviously not, and that she's just making art. She's amazing. She makes a canoe boat in the shape of her own vagina, and it's just amazing. Definitely go and see that. I think a film that's coming up that I would recommend is Wild Rose, which I saw at the LFF this year. It's produced by Faye Ward, who's an amazing producer, and it stars Jessie Buckley as a Glaswegian mother who's recently out of prison and dreams of becoming a country singer. And I was expecting it to be a bit cheesy, but it's absolutely pitch perfect. It's really uplifting, really funny. Beautifully shot and amazing performance by Jessie Buckley.
I think it does a very clever thing in that where most films end, it gets to, it's around its halfway point.
Yeah.
And it does something very clever, I think, with the sort of trying to make your dreams work out.
Yeah.
Storyline.
It's a kind of, every time you think it's going to go one way, it sort of wrong foots you and does something different. And it's just very clever and very well written. Loved it. So I think that's being released in April in the UK. So
yeah, I've started seeing some marketing out on Twitter and whatnot. Yeah. So. Also, I really want to know, because you said you were into short stories, is there like a collection of short stories that you'd also recommend?
Yeah, actually, I did a programme for NSFF a couple of years ago on Raymond Carver and Raymond Carver short stories, and a short film adaptation of his stories. We showed a really great film from like the late 90s, made in LA, called Tropical Fish, based on one of his films. I love his writing, and it was really interesting to explore how filmmakers had interpreted it on screen.
Amazing. I just bought What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Great.
And then finally, you have mentioned obviously like Mia and Ellen and mentors you've had across the industry or people that you've looked up to. Is there anyone else that you've worked with or that is doing great things at the moment that you particularly like to spotlight?
Yeah. So many. So what somebody who I work with at the British Council who's actually just gone on a sabbatical, Gemma Desai. She runs a programming initiative called I Am Dora, which looks at the ways that women relate to one another on screen. She also writes the most incredible letters to her daughter Lena, where she explores motherhood and the emotional bonds that she feels, the way that she's navigating through the world as a mother and not as a mother, as Gemma. And the writing is so, so powerful, and every time I read one of her letters I cry. and it's interesting because she's often writing about things relating to motherhood but that transcend motherhood and can make shine a really interesting light on parts of my life, and I'm sure therefore parts of everybody's lives. And it's a tiny letter, so you can sign up to it.
Oh, amazing. Joy, this has been so lovely. Thank you so much
for coming. Thank you. Such a pleasure.